So this is our reading group, continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism. We're picking up from page 99 of the translation. So we had started this current chapter last week, and this is going through here, or he's explaining in more depth his concept of an absolute surface, which is something that we've seen come up throughout the book and also in the cybernetics book. And I think maybe the most sort of straightforward example to explain this concept is his sort of contrast between a camera looking at his example that he gives on at the beginning of this chapter, a camera that looks at like a checkerboard surface, like a chessboard or a checkerboard. So the camera, of course, has some sort of light sensitive surface that each region of that surface has some sort of chemical or electronic or whatever change depending on the intensity and frequency of the light that is striking that portion of the surface. And then so there's some sort of correspondence between this, whether it's a film or a photosensitive cell or whatever, that there's a correspondence between a portion of that surface and a portion of the checkerboard. And then a human eye looking at the same checkerboard also has, of course, the retina, undergoes various chemical changes in response to the light that is striking that region of the retina. But the key difference here is that in the case of the camera, there has to be someone looking at the image produced by this camera, for example, like looking on a computer screen, or you print off the image, or looking at the film afterwards, etc. There has to be a sort of external eye that sees the image produced by this imaging process. Whereas in the case of the human eye, there isn't, of course, a second eye looking at the retinal image, or even a sort of like spiritual eye, an immaterial soul that is sort of looking at the retinal image. And I think it came up in the Merleau-Ponty book, the sort of like pseudo problem that came up in psychology, I think in like the 19th century, when anatomical dissections or physiology of the eye had determined that the image that is projected onto the back of the eye, onto the retina, is actually vertically inverted. So it's upside down relative to the objects that are in the outside world. So if you're looking at a tree, the image projected onto your retina will have the branches at the bottom and the ground at the top. And then there was this like question or problem of like, how do you sort of flip this image over to so that you see the tree, right side up and not upside down? And this, of course, this whole sort of question or problem presupposes that there's something that is looking at that retinal image at the back of your eye and, has to figure out that this image is upside down, which is not at all what is happening. There's no little person with their own eye inside your head that is looking at the image in the back of your eye. And if you were to try to explain visual perception in these terms of looking at a retinal image, then you would, of course, run into this infinite regress, because that little person in your head, their eye would also have an upside down retinal image that someone else would have to look at, and so on. So this retinal, the retinal image, or this sort of like immediate self-perception, the retina is not something that you have to look at and perceive. It is something that is part of the perceiving itself. This sort of immediate surface is Rie's model for this absolute surface. So it's a kind of intrinsically coherent, it has a sort of intrinsic structure. It's a surface that is sort of self-presented, that doesn't have to be like seen from a distance in the way that the checkerboard has to be seen from a distance. So that's like sort of the model for this concept, I think, or one of the main models. And so in the part that we read last week, he gives a funny sort of example of this kind of argument with, he has this little diagram of this man painting a landscape, but for the sake of accuracy, he has to include himself in the painting. He has to have a little drawing of the canvas and the easel and himself standing in front of it. But then, of course, his painting of his own canvas has to include himself in the painting on the canvas, and so on. So there's this nested self-representation here. And you know, the point, of course, is that perception is not this kind of doesn't involve this sort of infinite regress. It's this kind of immediate self-presentation, as opposed to a representation that involves this sort of infinite regress. Right, and then I'm just scrolling through where we are. Right, and then so he gives the sort of pair of diagrams. So the one is sort of like from the first person perspective, looking down at this desk, I guess, with a checkerboard pattern. And then he gives this sort of what he describes as the mythical third eye. So this would be like this sort of like spiritual eye, or you know, the pineal gland in Descartes' formulation, that would sort of look at the first person image from the previous diagram. So this would be the external sort of perspective on the image that is transmitted by the eyes. And so by designating it as mythical, he's of course, you know, saying that there is no such thing. And yeah, so that's sort of like the general point of this chapter, is essentially showing that third eye, or this external perspective on perception, is mythical. And then, yeah, so the last bit was essentially just the argument that he's made in other contexts, I think in the cybernetics book as well, is that if we suppose that there's something, you know, special about, like, say, the occipital lobe of the human brain that makes it, you know, capable of having, of you know, perceiving the world through this visual mode, I guess, and we say there's some sort of, like, there's something intrinsic to this region of the brain that, you know, makes it suited to have visual perception, then it's become sort of mysterious to, this region of the brain is just made up of neurons like any other region of the brain. And each of these neurons is not itself having a visual experience. It's just, you know, taking it, it's being affected by the, you know, incoming signals from other neurons. It's receiving neurotransmitters and then doing some sort of, you know, operation, summation or whatever of the incoming neurotransmitters, and then either firing or not firing. And so the sort of like standard, I guess, or this kind of standard depiction of what's going on is that somehow there seems to be this sort of like inner experience aspect of you know, the whole visual region of the cortex, that, you know, we see objects, we have an experience of you know, colors and textures and so on of objects, but the neuron itself would not have something, any kind of like inner experience. And that of course leaves us with this mystery of like, how do a bunch of, you know, cells that are just sort of firing or not firing, how does that sort of become, or how is it associated with this inner experience? And for Ruyer, this is kind of a sort of pseudo problem, because he's just going to assert that the neuron does have an inner experience. And he's pointing to things like, you know, an amoeba, for example, is sort of able to navigate the world and, you know, make decisions of a sort, you know, about, you know, where to move and so on, in the same way as a, you know, a multicellular organism does. But the amoeba doesn't have a nervous system. It's just one cell. There doesn't seem to be any sort of intrinsic property of multicellular organisms that would make them sort of uniquely capable of having an inner experience, whereas a single-celled organism would not, or a single cell within a multicellular organism would not. So this is his sort of panpsychist sort of framework, but the important qualification up to this term panpsychism is that this, you know, inner experience for him only applies to what he calls true forms and not aggregates. So, you know, the sort of stock example of an aggregate would be a pile of sand. There's no sort of, there's nothing it is like to be a pile of sand, but there might be something it is like to be a grain of sand, you know, depending on what exactly that sand is made up of. But yeah, so an atom or a molecule or a cell, these are true forms, but, you know, a pile of sand or a lump of rock or whatever is not a true form. So yeah, only the true forms have an inner experience. Okay, so I think we can pick up from page 99. go forward from there?
I can read. Up to now, we have proceeded as if quote-unquote absolute domain were synonymous with quote-unquote absolute surface, and our schemas have accentuated this impression. But because the absolute surface is intuited without a third dimension, nothing in fact prevents us from conceiving more general absolute domains, absolute volumes, for example. Primary organic consciousness has to resemble an absolute volume, an absolute surface, because when observed as a body, it appears as a volume. But because the geometric laws do not apply to the subjective domains, the primary consciousness of a three-dimensional organism, while constituting a form in which all the details are simultaneously present, does not require the hypothesis of a subject lodged in a fourth dimension. Primary organic consciousness must even correspond to an absolute domain of space-time. The organism is never an instantaneous anatomical structure. It is, rather, a cluster of processes. A species is characterized as much by the phases of its development as by its adult form. A quote-unquote type is spatio. Its embryological forms are part of its anatomy and space-time. Its development is inseparable from its being. In principle, absolute domains imply a possibility of time survey and space survey, but with limitations to which we'll return. In the case of absolute domains, it is the whole space-time of physicists that has to be a quote-unquote survey without any supplement mention. The survey of the quote-unquote eye is purely metaphorical. Quote-unquote inspection that the eye, in quotes, seems to perform on its domain of survey is equally metaphorical. In fact, domain I, in quotes, and ideal form. In fact, domain I and ideal form an indissociable whole that is active inspection. A different quote-unquote inspection corresponds to a change in the domain, a change in the quote-unquote figure or figure ground mutation. The role of the subjective domain in the regulation of subordinated organic mechanisms and tools is thus clear. These organic tools are not pure tools that are simply inspected by a custodian or a worker in the flesh. The extra-organic material tools and factories elude in great part their proprietor. Humans cannot be everywhere at once to ensure that everything runs smoothly and to repair what deteriorates. By contrast, the organic tools, at least in young organisms, are quote-unquote maintained by subjective equipotential domains that quote-unquote survey and quote-unquote inspect with the ubiquity inherent to subjective domains into absolute surfaces that repair them in case of light wear or lesion by correcting the blind operation of subordinate ambosceptors. The difference between the inspector in the flesh relative to his extra-organic tools and the field of inspection of organs is the same as the difference between the physical and technical conditions of observation and those of conscious sensation. In both cases, it is necessary to come to a stop without ascending to infinity. If a tiny internal inspector had to oversee the organism of the engineer by wandering in as the engineer wanders in the factory, who would oversee this internal inspector? Very fortunately for us, the inspection of our organs is final and absolute. It is self-inspection. By keeping track in his office of drawings and graphs to reproduce the state of machines and supplies in the distant factory, the engineer tries to imitate the mode of organic and cortical inspection. These graphs and drawings can be seen all at once, while the real factory operates semi-blindly by a succession of productions and services. And the engineer can avert a lack of coordination that emerges in the graphs before it is really experienced in the services. This quote-unquote artificial cortex must nonetheless rely on the real cortex of the engineer, who is an absolute surface, a drawing that reads itself. I'm not sure, I think I must have just skipped this part, actually, but I'm not sure I totally understand this point about absolute depth. Maybe he's saying that an organism is, unlike an absolute surface, it's multidimensional. So an organism is sort of a four-dimensional, but a self-surveying four-dimensional unity in the same way an absolute surface, or the surface of perception, I guess, is self-survey. And then this contrast between the engineer's metabolism and organic self-survey and his heteronymous survey of the factor is helpful. Getting a sense for what self-survey is, it's sort of like an immediate self-inspection, you know, that doesn't, it's not like a self-survey isn't some, an external observer kind of comes in and makes sure the organ is functioning. It's just the organ's instantaneous grasp of itself.
Yeah, this argument about the, you know, this, or this, you know, image of the factory inspector or the, you know, supervisor or whatever, it is a very similar type of argument as the argument about the, you know, retinal image and the, you know, this pseudo problem of the upside down image that I was talking about earlier. So of course, yeah, when you, if you have a factory as a, you know, an artifact, you know, produced by humans, so the person who is, or usually more than one person, but the people who are in charge of keeping that factory running the way that it is supposed to run, of course, are perceiving the factory as an object outside of them. They have to, you know, look at the dials on the machines, or, you know, hear how they sound, and do they smell smoke, etc. They have to sort of use their sensory capabilities to evaluate whether the machines are running the way they are supposed to, but the machines are, you know, another object, another entity independent of them. So they have this sort of external relationship to these machines. But then, of course, the body of that person who is in charge of monitoring the factory is also a kind of, you know, very complicated biological machine, or you know, a collection of biological machines. And so you might sort of suppose that there is a sort of a miniature factory supervisor in charge of their of that person's body, you know, a little person that wanders around and says, you know, checks that the heart is pumping properly and, you know, the liver is doing its job, etc. Of course, we know that there is not anything like this. The heart has its own sort of internal regulation of itself. It controls its own functioning, you know, of course, with connections to other organs, you know, depending on like the, you know, hormones in the blood can cause the heartbeat to increase, for example. But, you know, the organs don't require a sort of external supervision and, you know, monitoring to do what they do. And so is this contrast between this kind of external monitoring, you know, in the case of the factory, and this sort of self-monitoring or self-regulation in the case of the biological machines or the biological processes that he's pointed to here. And then going back to the earlier part where he's talking about an absolute volume as opposed to an absolute surface. So a lot of his examples are drawn from, you know, visual perception, like, you know, the checkerboard example, of course, is something you're looking at visually. And, you know, the term absolute surface suggests obviously a two-dimensional space, but he's pointing out here that because when he's talking, like, an absolute surface is not a surface in the same way that, you know, the top of a desk is a surface. It's not, you know, located in physical space. And so there's no sort of intrinsic reason why you would be restricted to a two-dimensional, you know, absolute surface. And then he points to the sort of self-regulation or self-production of biological organisms as pointing to the need to sort of extend this concept of an absolute surface to an absolute volume. So, it doesn't make any sense to imagine that, like, say, the heart's, self-regulation is made up of, like, a bunch of absolute surfaces, you know, heart slices that are, you know, each sort of regulating themselves. There's no reason to suppose that is the case. The heart is clearly is clearly not composed of, you know, heart slices that are themselves, you know, two-dimensional. And then he points out, of course, that living beings are not just a sort of static, you know, three-dimensional figure that just, you know, exists at this, you know, moment in time. And then they're not even, you know, time slices, three-dimensional time slices, you know, a sort of 3D printed figure at moment one, and then another 3D printed figure at moment two. And, you know, this would get us, of course, at the sort of Bergson argument about the cinematic illusion and so on. A living being has a certain temporal processes. Of course, there's the embryogenesis, which is a favorite topic for Rieu, but, you know, even something like the heart, of course, the whole point of a heart is that it contracts rhythmically. So this is a temporal process. So to really sort of grasp the operations of a heart, the functioning of a heart, it would have to be a four-dimensional hypervolume, I guess. It's an absolute hypervolume. It's, you know, it's the three-dimensional space of the heart, but then also the temporal dimension. So yeah, this whole sort of four-dimensional space or hyperspace has to be immediately self-grasping in the same way that the visual perception of the checkerboard is a self-grasping surface. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next bit. Organelles, would you like to read?
Are we starting with the difference between the inspector or here again?
I think we're at here again.
Okay. Here again, there is no doubt that absolute surfaces and absolute auto-subjective domains are primary relative to all the categories of pseudo-forms, patterns, structures, various assemblages, gestalten, and so forth, and cannot be composed of them. The drawings and graphs in the engineer's office postdate the factory, just as the visual sensation of the checkered table postdates to the table. But the engineer who built and assembled the factory clearly had, quote-unquote, in mind, an overall outline of the assemblage, just as the craftsman who created the checkerboard, quote-unquote, saw it, or referred to its image. If absolute surfaces are accepted as primary, then another paradox will arise. The history of evolution seems to require the idea of progressive formation instead of pre-existing absolute forms. The engineer's cortex, as well as his consciousness, precedes the drawing and graphs he uses. It was formed in the course of embryogenic development, but as we have seen, this cortex simply retains the equipotentiality of the embryo that derives from the equipotentiality of the egg, which in its turn derives from the germinal equipotential cells. Because equipotentiality is the typical manifestation of absolute forms, can be said that as high as one climbs in the history of living forms, one always discovers an absolute form that has subsisted uninterruptedly for hundreds of millions of years of biological evolution. From primitive living beings to humans and their brains, formation does take place, but this formation starts from a different absolute form and not from dispersed elements. There is a formation by continuous improvement in the constant presence of an organic domain. It is never a question of formation through the assemblage of bits and scraps. If there is, strictly speaking, no beginning for absolute domains, there cannot, in principle, be any end. In fact, we do not see how a subjective domain of self-inspection could come to an end on its own. Aging and death are conceivable only in the case of a secondary inspection, like the engineer's inspection of a factory. Bearing on machinery that is itself detached from organic subjectivity and repaired only at long intervals. The body of a metazoan is made up of organs that, macroscopically, are quasi-autonomous factories subject to the risk of equally macroscopic accidents. The possibility of replacing these organs with automata is the underside of their perishability. In contrast, the impossibility of replacing the living tissues as such with constructed automata is the underside of their imperishability. There are indeed microorgans in a protozoan, in a germinal cell, or in the cells of a tissue cultivated in vitro, but we should realize that these microorgans are not made up of autonomous ambosceptors. The subjective, quote-unquote, inspection is total and perfect, because all these living beings are potentially immortal, and that, from germ to germ, or from cell to cell, none of the currently living cells, derived by division or fusion from other cells, has ever died. The heart, as a large, innervated, and irrigated muscle, can malfunction, but the cardiac tissue, with its embryonic rhythm, is theoretically immortal. There is certainly a relationship between immortality and equipotentiality, because equipotentiality enables the regulation of lesions, because Lashley could not have carried out on the rat's heart the interventions he made on its cortex, and because embryologists can slice an egg or a young triton gastrula in two without killing it, whereas a sagittal or other cut of an adult T. gastrula would infallibly kill it. Like equipotentiality, virtual immortality is the sign of the presence of an absolute domain, whose primary inspection maintains its forms indefinitely. It is the sign that the microorgans the microorgan's order of magnitude is related to the order of magnitude of the dynamism inherent in primary subjective bonds. If virtual immortality is rarely real, it is because even an absolute domain can be violently destroyed by relatively immense forces, which result from accumulation in the world of physical aggregates. Even though its bonds may have primary order relative to step-by-step bonds of the physical world, they are quantitatively too weak to resist these forces. Owing to their more accentuated unity, the absolute domain of physics, atomic or subatomic individualities, have by contrast considerable binding energies. They are virtually immortal. It is well known that the disintegration of an atom is quite a story, much more so than the disintegration of a human being. Well, that last sentence is awesome. A few things he mentioned in the previous chapter, where he talked about the divisions and the replication of an absolute form and the different ways it could go about, it kind of talks about here that despite these divisions, there is some, I believe he's basically inferring that there's still some continuity throughout all of those. And also in the previous section, he asked, how could you imagine a consciousness emerging from an assembly of kind of material parts versus being there from the beginning? Kind of just going a little, making that point a little more clear here. One other quick side note, I need to think about this a little bit more, but it was interesting when he talks about the in vitro cells. And so it's kind of curious to think about all the in vitro cell work that goes on around the world, like the famous case of the HeLa cells that were taken from the lady back in the 50s, I believe at Johns Hopkins, and are still used in, thousands and thousands of experiments. Is he implying here that these also still maintain some of this absolute domain? So anyway.
Yeah, this sort of potential immortality sort of concept, I think either originates or definitely was sort of popularized by Weismann, who made this sort of conceptual division in the organism between the somatic line or the somatic cells and the germ cells. And so, of course, the sort of adult organism derives from an embryo. And then, most of the cells that make up the body of that organism, when that organism dies, those cells also die. But in a multicellular organism that we're talking about here, but if that organism has reproduced before it dies, then those reproductive cells have formed a new individual that itself creates its own new body, and so you can sort of trace a sort of lineage of those reproductive cells, this germ line, from any organism living today all the way back to the origin of life, or at least the origin of multicellular organisms. So this germ line is potentially immortal. Of course, many of those organisms will not have any offspring before they die. Those lines, those lineages die out. Any organism that does succeed in reproducing will that germ line will continue to live through time, through many generations. And so Rouillet is sort of like picking up on that concept here, but then he's applying it to his own concept of this absolute domain. This domain that say appeared with the first multicellular organism however many hundreds of millions of years ago, that domain is still around today in each of us, in any living being. It's just sort of divided into many sort of duplicate domains over time. Any one of us, in any individual instance, it might not succeed in reproducing. It might die before it reproduces. But in all the other instances, it will persist through time into the next generation. And then he points out here that there's this there's a sort of connection between this potential immortality on the one hand and what he's talked about earlier in terms of equipotentiality. And so his example here is, you know, you take all these sort of experiments that were done in early 20th century embryology, where you slice an embryo or a fertilized egg in half and, you know, swap the sides, or, you know, you do all kinds of like pretty extreme operations on this early stage embryo. And, you know, it's still able to produce a relatively normal looking adult organism, or you can even, you know, divide the early stage embryo in half and you just get two smaller adult organisms. But of course, if you tried to do the same type of operation on, you know, an adult organism, you would just kill the organism. You can't, you know, slice, a rat in half and have, you know, two, you know, normal looking rats that are just smaller. So it's precisely because this absolute domain has this equipotentiality, this capability of forming any part of the adult organism. It's precisely because of that it has also this potential immortality. And then as it sort of specializes, as it, you know, turns itself into, you know, not just a sort of generic rat part, but into a left leg or, I don't know, a tail or whatever, as it starts to specialize, it loses that sort of potential immortality. And it's only the germline of the rat that continues to have that potential immortality. And that also, of course, has this equipotentiality because it's the germline that will produce the next generation rat soma, the body of the rat. So yeah, it's the equipotentiality and potential immortality are sort of coordinate concepts. And yeah, the HeLa cell example is an interesting one. So for those who maybe are not familiar with this, so this was a woman who had cervical cancer, I believe. Yes. And yeah, that she went for treatment at Johns Hopkins hospital, and they, you know, took some of the cells from her body, like a tissue sample, without any sort of, you know, permission or consent or whatever, which apparently was like standard practice at the time. And then those cells it was possible to keep them alive essentially indefinitely in the lab, which is not usually the case. Like you can take sort of human tissue samples and have them, you know, reproduce in a culture medium, but usually not indefinitely. In this case, these cells were able to reproduce indefinitely. And that means you can use them for all kinds of experiments. You can test, like, is this candidate medication toxic, for example. You can use these cells to test it. Any sort of biological experiment that you're sort of wanting to see what this substance does to human cells, you can use these cells that are derived from this one woman. So there's like, you know, many thousands of experiments that have been done using her cells. As Organelle says in the chat here, it's probably billions of copies that have been produced in labs around the world in the subsequent 70 whatever years. So for many decades, these cells were just sort of like shared around by biologists, with no sort of regard for where they actually came from in the first place. And I think it's only relatively recently that there's been some attempts to like bring her family into the picture and have some sort of recognition for the role that her cells, and she ended up dying, you know, shortly after these cells were taken. I should have mentioned that earlier. So bringing her family in and having some sort of recognition that, you know, this one woman's cells that were taken without really any consent or compensation or anything have, you know, had a huge impact on biology and medicine, for decades. And, you know, there are probably many drug companies that have made many hundreds of millions of dollars in part based on, you know, using her cells. So I think there's been more attempts to sort of recognized that recently, but I'm not sure exactly what that has consisted in. Yeah, so that's sort of an aside, but it, yeah, so her cells have sort of, I guess, because of the nature of cancer and, you know, exactly how it sort of played out in her case, has sort of regained that potential immortality that normally a specialized, you know, cervical cell would not have. Yeah, so they've sort of like almost returned to a sort of embryological state in a sense.
Yeah, and here too, the he's definitely associating or kind of separating the idea of the absolute domain from strictly the material that might constitute it in the myriad ways, you know, across like consciousness or life or what, or across life, I suppose, you know, sort of. And I don't know quite how here, but it just, it sort of reminds me of the idea of the body without organs. Not saying that the two are one and the same, but these processes that constitute the material structures of these different absolute domains or of this singular absolute domain through time, how they are sort of the product of just these sort of blind processes, I suppose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think the connection with the you know, the concept of the body without organs is a good one here, because the organs in, you know, he's talking specifically about multicellular organisms. So a human body, of course, consists of all kinds of different organs that are, you know, specialized, that they have certain types of cells and tissues and so on. And these are, in a sense, you know, biological machines. You know, the heart is a sort of machine for pumping blood, etc. And it's precisely because they're specialized in this way that they don't have this equipotentiality anymore, and they aren't a sort of pure absolute domain in the way that the initial fertilized cell is, or is closer to, I guess. So you can think of it as like this sort of body without organs as kind of like the limit concept of, like, if you start from, say, like the adult organism with all its different specialized cell types and organs and tissues and everything, and then you sort of follow the, or you sort of trace backwards to the embryo, which, you know, can undergo all these sort of extreme interventions, like, you know, swapping the left and right sides, etc., and still sort of form a normal looking organism, and then you trace that back further to that initial fertilized cell, and the body without organs is kind of like the limit concept, if you just sort of like imagine tracing that back even further. Like, you know, the fertilized cell already has, you know, a nucleus and all sorts of organelles that are involved in, you know, producing proteins and so on, otherwise it wouldn't be able to, you know, turn into an adult organism. But you sort of like trace that even further back, or sort of imagine tracing that even further back to this, like, sort of before, like, in a sort of non-temporal before, you know, a prior sort of undifferentiated state that would be sort of underlying the already differentiated cell that is, you know, the fertilized egg. Yeah, so it's sort of like this sort of ground state of the organism that is just a sort of pure absolute domain. And then it's sort of on the basis of that these, you know, biological machines are then sort of assembled.
I don't know if this is meaningful or not, but also, you know, the concept of the body without organs as the limit, or as describing a limit of sort of non-material entities, say like capitalism or something like that, you know, these other things. I wonder how Ruyer's concept of absolute domains relates to that.
Yeah, Ruyer doesn't really give us any I don't know, social theory or anything like that in the way that Deleuze and Guattari will do later. But I mean, it's not, I guess, it's not really too much of a stretch, I think, to sort of imagine, you know, taking some of these concepts that he's applying to biological organisms and then sort of transferring them over to like a sociological process. So of course, you know, he's talked about here how, like in this book, about how, you know, like a cooking pot is essentially just an external stomach. You're just taking sort of like the digestive processes that would otherwise happen within an organism, and you're just displacing them outside an organism. And you can, you know, make a similar case about like all sorts of processes of, you know, taking in materials from the world and transforming them in some way, and, you know, making them serve purposes for human beings, you know, whether it's, you know, building a house or, you know, a bridge or an airplane, whatever, like you're taking in some sort of materials from the world, you're transforming them in various ways, and you're, you know, producing something that has some sort of desirable qualities for human beings, or at least some human beings. Yeah, so this is not really that different. It's sort of the same, you know, I guess, abstract schema as, you know, an organism that ingests substances from its environment. It takes in food or nutrition or whatever, you know, carries out various chemical transformations of what it's ingesting, and turns them into, you know, its own tissues, or it sort of takes in whatever it needs from whatever it's ingesting, and transforms it. Of course, the sort of assimilation of a sort of economic process to a metabolism of an organism is a, you know, an old sort of concept, and this even goes back, like, you know, pretty like early, like I think, like, even in the 18th century, you had like writers who were talking about like the vital economy of a living being. Like they were sort of describing a living being as an economy, though here I think the economy probably had more like the Aristotelian sense of like a household management kind of sense. But yeah, so this sort of, there's been sort of like a back and forth of, you know, concepts going from the study of living beings to the study of you know, social organization and its, you know, sort of interaction with the environment. So the same sort of concepts get sort of passed back and forth multiple times. And yeah, so it doesn't seem like a big stretch to say that, you know, if there is this sort of absolute surface or absolute domain sort of principle going on in living beings, in the way that Ruyer is describing, that social organism or social organization that is analogous in some sense to living beings would also have that same sort of absolute domain kind of principle governing it. Yeah, Ruyer doesn't, of course, make that extension, but I think you can see a lot of what Deleuze and Guattari are doing as like a sort of pushing the concept into that domain, extending it into that domain that Ruyer doesn't do himself.
Do you know, by any chance, has anyone explored that connection?
Like explored the sort of way that that Deleuze, yeah, and Guattari are using his concept?
Or kind of connecting them, and then how D and G kind of extend that concept.
I don't know for sure. I don't really know the secondary literature on Ruyer very much at all. So yeah, I'm not sure if anyone, you know, comes across something like that would be interesting to look at. So it's possible. I mean, I think it's only fairly recently that there's been much sort of interest in, you know, secondary literature on Ruyer at all. So I think it's still a fairly small sort of domain of study. So it may not have really, there may not be anything that has sort of looked at that specifically, but there might be, and I just don't know of it. Okay, yeah, so that was the end of the chapter, but I think we can go on to the next one and read at least the first few pages. So yeah, I can start the reading of the next chapter here. So the title is Absolute Domains and Bonds. Is he going to have a chapter about stocks later as well? We can have a... Anyway, sorry. Dumb joke. Okay. Right. As we just saw, the absolute domains of survey are not assemblages of bits and scraps. Even though it is complex and supplies the details of the pattern, the sensation of the surface is not composed of small squares glued together, just as they are on the physical table. And yet, we also spoke of the internal bonds, liaison, of an absolute domain, and even of the variable energy of these bonds. A bond implies, it seems, bound parts. There is no contradiction here. The internal bonds do not explain the domains. On the contrary, it is the domains that explain the bonds. The analysis of the notion of quote-unquote bond shows that it implies an absolute domain of self-survey. This is even one of the shortest paths by which to arrive at the idea of, quote, absolute survey, unquote. In passing through the history of scientific philosophy, we notice that a concept as significant as the quote-unquote bond was greatly neglected. It is true that science has not tackled the problem in earnest until quite recently, with wave mechanics and Eitler and London's research on molecular bonds. Previously, philosophers had to confine themselves to notions drawn from global physical experience, such as quote-unquote plenitude, quote-unquote solidity, in the Democritean sense, quote-unquote attraction, and quote-unquote field, or to engage in abstract discussions on internal relations and external relations a la Bradley and his admirers or opponents. By definition, pure observation cannot reveal the bonds of the observed being, because the waves or photons it emits only retain a pattern of it without internal bonding, or with bonds that differ completely from those of the observed being. We can only arrive at the proper bonds of an object in two ways. Abstractly, by an induction drawn from prolonged observations, which shows the degree and mode of consistency of the object, or concretely, by a kind of analogical animation that seizes the being behind the object and quote-unquote knows its proper sense or coherence. Let us consider, for example, the glue that binds the fragments of the marquetry. How can this glue bind? Beyond the explanations that derive from science's, quote, average regions, unquote, properties of colloidal micelles, structure of molecules, we have to reach the moment when physical elements contiguous to one another are nevertheless immediately unified. So we encounter here again either the necessity of an infinite regress, a glue is needed between the elements of the glue for it to be adhesive and so forth, or a domain of absolute bonds. This domain of bonds is none other than the domain of absolute survey we already know. So he's going to talk here about a figure which, yeah, we'll get to as we go along. Let A and B be bound elements that we can assume to be binders of other elements A and B, figure 34. So maybe I'll describe here. So what it shows here is essentially a rectangle with, subdivisions in it. And you have one division labeled big A on the left and another division labeled big B on the right. And then you have in between these two divisions, you have a small a and a small b. That's sort of the top row. And then the bottom row shows the small a and small b fused together. And so you have, you can think of the small a and small b as the sort of glue that is connecting big A and big B. I'm just going to read the last sentence again because it leads into the following one. Let A and B be bound elements that we can assume to be quote-unquote binders of other elements, big A and big B. If they are simply juxtaposed, both as observed objects and in their very being, each absolutely enclosed on itself and each really quote-unquote next to each other, how can they be unified and how can they serve to unify big A and big B? But if their domains are superimposed on one another, and if the superimposition is not understood once more as a simple juxtaposition or a simple mixture, which would not clarify the matter because the mixture would bring us back to the, quote, average explanations, unquote, of science and would implicate sub-individualities of little a and little b, alpha and beta, which are themselves juxtaposed. If the domain of superimposition is at once a and b, if it is a b considered as a new being with an auto-subjectivity and a self-survey, then the bond can be understood. Contemporary physics discovered that the interaction of similar particles bound in a system is necessarily correlated to a loss of the individuality of these particles. Variables A and B can no longer be identified in an absolute way. They no longer represent impenetrable domains in space. They are domains of the possible localization of what we observe as a corpuscle. In the domain AB, which belongs both to A and to B, A and B become indiscernible, and it is no longer possible at any moment to tell whether we are dealing with A or with B. Thus, even the domains that are schematized as purely A or purely B can no longer be so because in the mixed domains, A and B exchange their roles. This possibility of role exchange in the course of A and B's interaction in the common domain AB is dynamically translated as exchange energy, and it is the basis of chemical valence, or more exactly, of covalence, in contrast to the heteropolar bond between ions, sodium chloride type. Okay, I'll stop here. So this is, again, one of these sort of infinite regress arguments here applied to this notion of bonding. He has a sort of a genius for, I think, selecting these very visualizable sort of examples. So you can think of like you're trying to glue two pieces of wood together. So you have your two pieces of wood you put some glue on the one, and you take the second one, and you stick it onto the glue. So here, of course, the glue is sort of connecting one piece of wood to the other, is, you know, making them stick to each other. But then you could ask, you know, you have, you know, your glue is also next to the wood. You know, what is connecting the glue to the wood on either side? And you could suppose that there is like a sort of meta glue that you need to add to your first glue to make the glue stick to the wood. But that, of course, doesn't really get you anywhere, because then you would need to know how the meta glue sticks to the first order glue and so on. There has to be something, you know, about the glue itself that makes it sort of intrinsically sticky. That sort of, it has this like intrinsic bonding character to it, that doesn't require some other entity to make it stick to something else. This is already a sort of absolute survey or absolute domain, obviously a very simple one in comparison to, you know, the absolute domain that is the whole sort of life course of a living being. So we're already in the realm of absolute survey here, even with something as simple as, you know, glue sticking to wood. So the point here is that this sort of stickiness or you know, these properties of substances, you know, whether it's glue or whatever, can't be sort of reduced to just one thing being next to another thing. You know, these two entities would be sort of, you know, self-contained, and would just sort of be located next to each other in this external way. This doesn't really get us anywhere in terms of explaining the properties of glue or any other substance. There has to be this sort of this absolute survey or this absolute domain that accounts for the bonding from, you know, that is the stickiness of the glue or any other property of any other substance. And so there's a question in the chat about the, you know, what he's talking about here in relation to physics. So I think this is around the time that quantum field theory was being developed. So I don't think he's like explicitly pointing to quantum field theory. Wave mechanics was one of the sort of early formulations of what, you know, became quantum physics. It turns out to be equivalent to the sort of matrix mechanics that Heisenberg developed. He's not really going into a lot of the details. I don't think he needs to here. I think that the main point here is that in a sort of classical like Newtonian framework, you can sort of represent particles as these, you know, point masses that kind of secondarily interact with each other, you know, through things like a gravitational force or electromagnetism or whatever. So that the particles are these entities that have a sort of intrinsic existence as they're the sort of self-contained entities, and then you sort of secondarily add on some interactions between them. Oh, we lost our questioner. I'll just continue with this point. In Newtonian or classical mechanics, you have the sort of self-contained particle that then secondarily interacts with another particle. I think the idea that Huy is pointing to here is that in a quantum system, when you have like these entanglement relationships between particles, that is no longer possible to depict the interaction of particles in this sort of extrinsic way, that they have this sort of intrinsic relation to each other.
I was asking the question, is he more like using quantum theory, or is he more inspired by other French philosophers, you know, like Deleuze, or is he only in this book?
The quantum physics stuff is not really like a sort of central reference for what he's talking about here, not really a central reference in the book as a whole, but in this passage, yeah, he is specifically referring to quantum physics. I think only in a very sort of general sense. Like, he's not, you know, going into any detail about a specific experiment design or anything like that. So most of his concepts are being drawn from biology in this book. So he is referring to quantum physics as sort of like another realm in which these concepts of an absolute domain also apply. He does mention Bradley in that passage that I just read. So this is F.H. Bradley, who was sort of known as like a British Hegelian. I'm not sure quite how accurate that term is. This sort of British Hegelian school, I think, was not that Hegelian really, but one of the sort of like concepts that is maybe more that is sort of associated with Bradley's work is precisely this notion of internal relations. And Angus has put a comment in the chat about this concept. Yeah, so he talks about how if you if you're sort of trying to understand what it means for, you know, two objects to be related to each other, so you have A and B are, you know, related through some relation R, then you're sort of by virtue of asserting that there is this relation between A and B, you're also asserting that there is a relationship between A and R. So A has the relationship of being one of the relata of R, for example. So for A to be related to B through relation R, then A also has to be related to R through relation R2. And then, of course, you know, the same sort of argument gets you to R3 and so on. So you get the sort of infinite regress that, like, any relation has a sort of infinite hierarchy of these sort of meta relations. This is a sort of like a more abstract formulation, I guess, of what I was saying before about, like, you know, the glue that sticks your two pieces of wood together. If you sort of ask yourself, you know, what is sticking the glue to the wood, then you end up with a, you know, second order glue, and then, you know, third and fourth, etc. Of course, we know in like physical experience that you don't need to add like a second glue to stick your first order glue to the wood. The glue itself sort of does the sticking. So what Rui is pointing to here is that there is this kind of direct bond, this sort of immediate bond that doesn't require something else external to it to perform its bonding. You don't need a second order glue to stick your glue to your wood. And it's precisely this sort of immediate bonding or this direct bonding that he's pointing to as like the what is characteristic of an absolute domain.
I'm still sort of trying to think through this chapter, which I read earlier today, but this idea that there's this with the hydrogen bonding. I don't know if he's gotten into that example, but there's a kind of loss of individuality. Well, there is a loss of individuality at the level of elements. So when the electrons of the two hydrogen atoms are in this kind of shared orbit, in this this kind of indiscernible zone where you can't really tell, or there's a constant exchange, so that at any given moment, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to say that, you know, one electron is the electron of atom one or of atom two. That kind of loss of individuality at the subordinate level, I guess, there's a kind of compensating gain in individuality at the level of what is now a new true form. It seems pretty fairly easy to align with Simondon, that there's this stable stable state that is, you know, reached out of a initial metastable tension, and sort of the finding of that stable state is sort of the same thing as the gain in individuality at the higher level, I guess.
Yeah. So the electron example is he sort of points to this towards the end of the passage that I just read. So when he talks about covalent bonds, so if you have like the very simple example would be like a hydrogen atom has one electron, and you can form a molecule of two hydrogen atoms, And so there are two electrons in this molecule, but there's no way to sort of look at a hydrogen molecule and say this atom, this electron comes from, you know, the hydrogen atom on the left, and this other electron comes from the hydrogen atom on the right. It's just that you have two hydrogen atoms that form a molecule, and there are these two electrons, but the two electrons are sort of shared by the two atoms that go into that molecule. And it seems to be the case, it has been argued that it's the case. It's not just that there's a limit on our sort of knowledge of these atoms, that, like, you know, just sort of externally, it's hard to determine which electron belongs to which atom. The argument is that there is intrinsically nothing about either of these electrons that makes it, you know, identical to the electron from atom one versus atom two. That there just is a sort of indetermination, like ontologically undetermined, you know, which electron belongs to which atom. This is what he's sort of pointing to in general in his concept of this bonding, that there's nothing about you know, any of these sort of bonding elements that makes it, you know, come from part A versus part B. There has to be this sort of intrinsic fusion sort of affects that bonding, as opposed to having, you know, one part next to another part, in, you know, even if next to is understood in a very sort of abstract sense.
I can read the next section. Are we at no doubt?
Yes.
Okay. No doubt the spatial schema on the physical surface of this page completely distorts the notion of bonding. AB appears as partes extra partes. The spatial schema also distorts the physical interaction, which cannot be represented in the ordinary three-dimensional space. But the essential point is that the binding energy appears at the moment when the elements bound within a system lose their individuality. The domain A, the domain B, and the domain AB cannot be understood as spatial in the ordinary sense of the term. Rather, they are absolute domains, like the sensation table, which is not quote-unquote spatial to form a unitary system. In this sense, it can be said that a field of consciousness, or of subjectivity, is a typical domain of bonds, on the model of which we should conceive the domains of microscopic bonds that ensure the coherence of physical individualities, and, indirectly, the solidity of physical aggregates through step-by-step interassemblage. Pascal Jourdain proposes to consider even the quote-unquote largest organisms as part of the world of microphysics, because they have an organic unity and a unity of behavior that can be linked through the genes to systems on the order of magnitude of atomic systems. Provided we do not insist too much on questionable considerations, this idea is perfectly true. The elephant, we might say, is a macro-microscopic being. Likewise, and by taking things from the other end, we can consider the bonds inherent to the absolute domains to be of the same general type as the bonds of microphysics. A field of consciousness seems to be too quote-unquote vast, if this term is meaningful, and complex to represent the schematic type of bonding in the same way that a large mammal cannot be easily described as quote-unquote microscopic. And yet, like the elephant's organism, human consciousness has a more primary unity, a more primary type of bonding than a grain of sand. The primary type of every bond is, quote, absolute survey, that is, being together as immediate form. The glue can glue, and steel or diamond can be solid, only through the microscopic action of domains of absolute survey. We invert things when we explain the unity of an equipotential domain through bonds or fields borrowed from the order of macroscopic physics, which has only retained the step-by-step action from the phenomena and not the elementary bonds that can make the quote-unquote step-by-step binding and the glue adhesive. Physiology and philosophy insist almost exclusively on consciousness as knowledge. Consciousness is also a binding force. Consciousness is indissociably both knowledge and binding force. Let us imagine that only a single man remains in the universe, ending his life as a hermit, repairing his cabin, cultivating his garden, and creating some tools. Without dying, he becomes unconscious. The suppression of his consciousness will not be ineffective, as the epiphenomenists claim. nor will it be totally effective. The flowers will continue to grow in the garden. Heaven will not collapse immediately. The suppression of consciousness will nevertheless condemn this small human world to eventual dissolution. The unmaintained cabin will fall into ruins. The garden will become wild again. In short, the suppression of conscious connections will suppress the corresponding forms. Consciousness is cognitive relative to ideals and quote-unquote binding relative to physical beings, which it informs according to the ills. I'll read. We discover similar results by following another order of considerations. As a unity in the multiplicity, an absolute domain or a true form realizes the otherwise inconceivable synthesis of being and having. Is the same system AB, A and B, or does it have A and B as parts? Does the surveying unity have the details it surveys, or because the survey is purely metaphorical, is it the very totality of the surveyed details? The term to be signifies in this case, quote, to consist of, unquote, having as opposed to being only in this sense. Quote unquote being is taken in the sense of, quote unquote, proper existence. Having will, in contrast, presuppose being. Ultimately, if to be signifies, quote, to consist of, unquote, the subject of the verb to be is only a linguistic convenience, because it simply designates the whole of its component elements. Because it is nothing by itself, it can possess nothing. A manufactured machine or a piece of furniture, like the inlaid table, does not float as a unity above its components. If the word table is employed as the subject of a predicative phrase, this would be a simple manner of speaking and an implicit reference to the machine or to the piece of furniture conceived by the engineer or the craftsman. In effect, the table was drawn as a table, that is, as the theme of a table, with determined traits that the craftsman selected. It is from domains of subjectivity that material objects borrow their unitary being and the possibility of, quote-unquote, having their properties. The absolute domains must therefore engender, on their own, the synthesis of the unity of being and the multiplicity of havings. Oh yeah, I forgot how dense that last paragraph was. Yeah, I love that line in that second paragraph about the elephant being a macro-microscopic being. Rouillet's division of things, I guess, is this division between true forms and agates. So in that sense, elephants and atoms are sort of share a genus, which is a cool Leibnizian ontology. The point that he makes about human consciousness, or really consciousness in general, being this domain of liaisons, and that despite, you know, the obvious differences between molecular bonding, or covalent bonding, and conscious perception in a human being, they are the same insofar as they have this this form of bonding that kind of creates a unity out of some pre-existing multiplicity. It's very cool to come to Rouillet after spending some time with Husserl. I think I mentioned that before, but just Rouillet gives you a perspective from which you can see human conscious intentionality as just a kind of subset of this much broader domain of ideal liaisons or absolute survey, so that there's a kind of intentionality to the hydrogen atom as well. And I want to reread this last paragraph in French because some of this doesn't make sense to me, but I think the basic idea is that there's this unity of being and having, that, you know, the ideal liaisons are the synthesis of a unity or of some multiplicity. So there isn't really, it sort of doesn't sit easily in either the category of unity or the category of multiplicity. Maybe a substantive multiplicity would be a good way to describe it.
Yeah, that last paragraph is very sort of like abstract. You can almost picture like some like medieval, you know, scholastic philosopher, you know, sort of parsing out what, you know, to be and to have mean and so on. I think we can also maybe make a connection here with this sort of like slogan that Hegel comes up with at one point, of the identity of identity and difference, where so on the one hand, you could take something like a table to just be like a name for the collection of parts. You know, there are, you know, four legs or however many legs and a surface. And then you could, you know, say each of these legs consists of, you know, so many, you know, cells of this, you know, piece of wood and, you know, all these molecules, et cetera. So every, you know, component of the table would itself consist of many other components. And, you know, the table would be nothing more than just the collection of all of these components. So that would be one sort of perspective on the table. The other perspective would be that, you know, the table is this kind of ideal unity that, you know, the person who made the table, or the people, if it's a sort of industrially produced table, there was some sort of like, you know, concept of the table or form of the table that preceded the creation of this table. And this sort of like table image is sort of the core out of which or in connection with which all the different parts are put together. And this would be, the table would be this kind of, you know, abstract essence of tableness that would have the parts as a sort of adjunct or something. These are sort of like two different ways of looking at a table. You know, in the case of the table, the sort of abstract table essence seems a little bit artificial. In the case of the living being, of course, you know, this is what he's been arguing throughout this book. It's that, you know, there that sort of form, the sort of intrinsic form of the organism is something that is not sort of an external you know, concept or representation or image that is like applied to the organism from without in a way that you could say for the table. So the organism on the one hand does consist of all these parts, you know, cells that themselves consist of, you know, organelles and molecules and atoms as you sort of descend the hierarchy. But then on the other hand, the organism is not just a sort of collection of cells or just a collection of molecules. There is this sort of intrinsic form of the organism that has the molecules. But what he's pointing to here is that you can almost put this in like a sort of second order argument, though he doesn't do this exactly here. But like, if you take the consisting of relationship and the having relationship, you could ask, you know, are these two sort of relationships themselves just sort of like externally next to each other, or are they sort of intrinsically connected? So like, is the organism as collection of molecules on the one hand, and then the organism as intrinsic form on the other hand, are these two aspects of the organism themselves sort of external to each other? And he, of course, is going to say that they are not external to each other. But, you know, he's also not going to say that they're, you know, identical. They're sort of, they have the same kind of unity that is also a multiplicity as, you know, the organism itself has. It's a unity that is at the same time multiplicity, or a unity, identity that is also difference. It's this sort of it's a concept that I think in Hegelian terms you would say it can't be sort of grasped by the understanding. It's not a concept that you can sort of pin down as like, you know, it consists of these properties or something like that. It's a kind of dynamic concept that as soon as you try to pin it down, it sort of escapes your pinning and turns into the opposite of what you thought it was.
Yeah, I like the example of the hermit's cabin. This, maybe it's just the progression of the argument and moving from the example of the covalent bonding to the cabin. But the for Rouillet, it's the same kind of ideal liaison and the instantiation of that bond that characterizes covalent bonding and, you know, like human tool maintenance, tool creation, which also sort of situates for me his kind of overall position, the cybernetics book, in relation to his broader. We've talked about that relation between the books a few times. Yeah, discussing neo-finalism, but yeah, I guess the cybernetic machine or AI, or I guess maybe a better way to say it, the framing consciousness that he talks about. So the cybernetics book is this domain of absolute survey to the engineer or engineers, that sets up machine, however complicated it is, in the first place, in a way that's analogous to embryonic growth or molecular bonding, although different, I guess, in that it's kind of externally oriented. In the case of the oriented, its activity is oriented towards itself, external tool.
Yeah. So in the case of, in the, for those who are maybe listening and were not haven't heard the discussion at the cybernetics book. So in that book, he talks about framing versus framed consciousness. So like I think one of his examples is in sort of the early history of cybernetics, there were these like one of the sort of instigations for the development of what became cybernetics was the targeting of anti-aircraft guns during World War II. And so you had like a radar and a person looking at the screen that would then, send signals using the, controllers to, turn the anti-aircraft gun in a certain direction. The problem that comes up is that, of course, the airplane is traveling relatively quickly, and you need to target not where the airplane is now, but where it will be by the time the bullet or shell or whatever reaches that location. So it you can't just sort of rely on the person just sort of by hand pointing the gun in the right place. So they developed different, automated mechanisms to sort of enable the person to target the right location. But so in this whole sort of setup, the person is sort of in the middle of the whole, chain of automated mechanisms. You have, a sensor, the radar at one end, and then you have the effector at the other end that moves the gun, and the person is essentially operating as like one component of this chain. Just at that time, of course, there was no AI or anything like that. There was no automated system that could be put in that segment of the chain that could reliably distinguish whether this is an airplane or a flock of geese or whatever. So in this case, the consciousness or the human being is framed by the sort of automated or machine segments of the chain on either side, on the input side and the output side. But of course, this chain that has the machine elements and human elements didn't sort of spontaneously assemble itself. There was a person who decided, or a group of people that decided, we're going to build a radar installation here. We're going to set up a anti-aircraft gun here. We're going to assign people to operate this radar and anti-aircraft gun installation. So there were people who decided, to set up the whole thing and to keep it in operation. You have to maintain the machines. You have to ensure that the people are trained, etc. Everything has to be kept in operation. And so this person or set of people is the sort of framing consciousness that is kind of, you could sort of depict as being outside, like an additional segment on either side of the chain that that was set up in the first place. And so this is the sort of distinction between framing and framed consciousness. And so in this example of the cabin, you have the person, this hermit, is sort of arranging this cabin plus garden, those tools, etc. It's sort of making a decision that I'm going to build a cabin in this place. I'm going to keep the cabin repaired, in good shape if there's a storm or whatever. So they're sort of like doing all this work to keep the cabin operating, to keep the garden weeded and maintained, etc. If that person disappears, the cabin doesn't just sort of crumble into dust immediately. The garden doesn't, die out immediately. But over time, the cabin will start to decay without repairs. The tiles of the roof will fall down, etc. The garden will start to, grow wild. Other plants will take over. Over time, the sort of role or the role of the person, if that role of the person is not being exercised to sort of keep the cabin plus garden, in a certain state, it will sort of sort of go back to its sort of most probable undisturbed state. The cabin will eventually, you know, collapse. The garden will eventually just be indistinguishable from the surrounding landscape. But yeah, so the person here is playing the role of that framing consciousness in the same way that the, you know, the, I don't know, military commander that decided to build an anti-aircraft installation and keep it running in a certain place was playing in the other example.
I that paragraph almost sounded to me like his own fantasy. Like sometimes he just sits back and dreams of being the last human on Earth, you know, maintaining a small cabin and garden.
Yeah, maybe he wrote a secret, you know, Robinson Crusoe type of example of, you know, himself keeping his desk tidy and tending his garden as the last person alive.
One can dream.
Okay, so yeah, we're about at our 2 hour mark, so I think we can stop here for today. Sorry, let me just check my schedule. Yeah, so next week should be good. The week after, I'm gonna have to skip because I'll be traveling, but yeah, next week should be fine. So yeah, thanks everyone for coming out, and yeah, hope to see you next week.